that's signaling. And we're going to talk today largely about chemical signaling, how you send a message from one cell to another. Because so far we've been talking about what goes on in one cell, and to run a multicellular organism, obviously you have to coordinate. Then next time, and for the next two times, Dr. Feierstein is going to talk about electrical communication, how nerves communicate. And then after he finishes, we will wrap up anything he doesn't get to or I don't get to today about both nerve and chemical communication. I know this is not the ideal order of lectures. It's partially because of all the conflicting schedules and holidays involved and vacations. This was the only time we could get Dr. Feierstein. And as you'll see when he talks, he's a wonderful lecturer, and I didn't want to give it up. The exam next week will cover through today. It will not cover Dr. Feierstein's material, but I strongly advise you to come anyway. It's really worth it. Now, there are many ways to look at how chemical signaling works. And the notes and the handouts supplement each other, and I'm going to try and go over it more or less in the order it's in the notes, but it may not be exactly. Because what I want to do to start is to take handout 12A, which is a summary of the signaling business, and explain how it works. Now, you can start by looking at it from the signal end or from the receptor end. The same molecules are used in many different contexts for signaling. As you'll see, there's a very limited number of molecules that seem to be suitable for this purpose. But they can be classified into two major categories. So if you look at the top of your handout, we have a symbol for the two major types of signals: lipid-soluble and water-soluble. Now, each of these has a corresponding type of receptor. And this is actually summarized on the bottom of your handout, where we put the signals here and the receptors here, so you can keep it straight, that the two categories of signal, water-soluble and lipid-soluble, and they're underneath the pictures of the right kind, that water-soluble, every signal has to have a receptor. But where the receptor is different. For lipid-soluble signals, the receptor is actually inside the cell. So it's intracellular. And that's shown in the picture here, where here's the target cell, and the receptor is inside. But for water-soluble signal, the receptor is transmembrane. So we've actually, in the picture, it looks like this. Didn't draw the whole cell. Whoops, that's the wrong one. That's the transmembrane signal. For a lipid-soluble signal, the receptor is internal to the target cell. While for a water-soluble signal, the receptor is on the surface of the target cell. Now, people sometimes refer to these as extracellular receptors. Is this protein extracellular? Notice it's not. But the domain of the receptor that's going to bind the ligand or the signal is extracellular. And so it's better to call it a cell surface receptor, but that's what people have in mind, that the ligand binding domain is extracellular. Then there's the transmembrane part locking the receptor in the membrane. And then there's, of course, the intracellular domain. Now, Now, what happens when the signal molecule or the ligand binds its receptor? That's actually the same in both of these cases, in general principle, that when the ligand binds its receptor, the receptor changes conformation. And so we've shown that both times. So you get a change in conformation on binding of the signal. Now, in the case of a lipid-soluble signal, why don't we need a surface receptor? Lipid-soluble molecules can transverse membranes. So by simple diffusion, the lipid-soluble molecule signal can actually leave the cell that makes it and enter its target cell. Now, as is mentioned later in your notes, if it's lipid-soluble, though, it can't travel very far without being bound to some kind of protein, because lipid-soluble stuff can't move or dissolve in the liquids of the body. So it can leave the cell that makes it. It usually binds to a protein. If especially if it goes through the blood, if it doesn't go very far, it may not need a protein. And then it can diffuse into its target cell. And now the receptor ligand complex is inside the target cell. So it doesn't seem so hard to believe that we're going to get some action inside the cell because we're inside it. On the other hand, if you have a water-soluble signal molecule, it has to bind on the outside of the cell. And usually these signals don't enter their target cell at all. If they do, they're degraded. So how are we going to get some action on the inside of the cell? Notice that the intracellular domain of the receptor has changed conformation. And that is going to trigger changes on the inside of the cell. Now, this is called the Big Bang model of signaling. Because what's going on here is you start out with a very small number of signal molecules binding to their respective receptors. And you get a big response in the cell. You get a big change. So how does this little tiny amount of signal produce a big change, which is what I mean by the Big Bang? And there are three major methods, which are listed on this handout, of getting a big result from a small amount of signal. And they're listed here, left, middle, and right. And let's look at them. How do you get, in other words, amplification of your signal? In the case on the left, it involves ion channels. And we'll briefly outline this today, but this is what Dr. Feierstein is going to talk about, because this is the big deal in nerve conduction. Alternatively, you can have what's called a modification cascade, which is written not at the top, but in the middle of the second category. We'll explain why. Or you can get transcription translation. Now, how does each of these produce an amplification effect? Ion channels, remember, are usually gated. That is, some signal opens them. So what happens here is that the binding of the ligand opens a ligand-gated channel, as it says on your handout. So you open a ligand-gated channel. But you've only got a little bit of signal, so you only open a few channels. And a few ions then enter or leave. But now that changes the distribution of ions across the membrane. That changes the charge across the membrane and changes the polarization. In this case, let's say it depolarizes. It reduces the charge difference across the membrane until you reach a threshold. Well, if you change the polarization across the membrane, what can you then open? you can open a voltage-gated channel. So if you reach the proper threshold, now you open voltage-gated channels. But you open a lot of those. So a little signal opens the ligand-gated channels. That causes ions to flow, and that opens the voltage-gated channels. So now you open the voltage-gated channels, and now relatively more ions change. And now you get your big bang or your big effect. In the case of nerves, you generate an action potential. In the case, also in the case of muscle, which generates a contraction. So you get quite a large change and then some actual physiological effect due to ion channels. So one ion channel opens another and you get a big bang. Now, what's the modification business? Now notice that this process used a transmembrane protein as the receptor and of course also as the channel. The channel has to be a transmembrane protein too. Now, how else can a transmembrane receptor generate a big result besides opening channels? One way it can do that is that the transmembrane protein, which has now, I should write it from here. So one possibility is this. The transmembrane protein, which has now changed conformation, can either generate a second messenger and or bind to a protein. Now, what are we talking about here? This intracellular domain has changed conformation, and that can cause it to bind to another protein. And that protein itself may do something. In fact, that protein might even be a channel. Often, though, the protein that the receptor sticks to is an enzyme, and it generates a small molecule inside the cell. People refer to the ligand as the first messenger, but it's outside the cell. Inside the cell, enzymes can be activated to generate a small messenger molecule inside the cell. Now, this is not messenger RNA. This is a small molecule which can diffuse through the cell and activate things. And this is what is known as the second messenger. So either through directly binding to a target protein or through generating a second messenger, some further protein in the cell is modified. Let's say it gets a phosphate or a phosphate comes off. And then that protein modifies other proteins which modify other proteins. Now, this sounds like the classic domino effect, where A hits B, hits C, hits D. But it's more than that. It's not just a domino effect. It's what's called a cascade, meaning that you get amplification because one molecule of some enzyme gets modified. So that means it can affect many molecules of target. It converts a lot of substrate to product. But each of those molecules of product might be an enzyme. And they will convert, each of them, many molecules of their target. So you get an extreme amplification step. Usually there are several steps in here where one molecule modifies 10 or 100, each of those modifies 10 or 100, each of those modifies 10 or 100, and you get a huge result. And the final result is lots and lots of active enzyme producing lots and lots of whatever the right product is. You get a big result. So that's what's meant by a modification cascade. And notice that what you usually change is protein activity. Sometimes one of these proteins is a transcription factor, and that alters transcription translation. But a good deal of the time, you do not in any way affect transcription translation. You just make the proteins that are already in the cell work better or work worse. and they are not usually transcription factors. And so you get a big effect. The classic example of this is how hormones regulate the breakdown of glycogen. This was the first example to be discovered, and people have calculated that the degree of amplification involved is millions to billions. Each of your textbooks has a calculation. They don't get the same number, but the point is that they get a huge number at the end. Okay. So this is two ways you can get amplification. And both of these involve transmembrane receptors and generating largely changes in the cell of what is already there. What is already there is activated, moves around, etc. But another way of getting amplification is to make new protein. And this is what generally happens with lipid-soluble signals. The situation here is that the receptor for these lipid-soluble signals is almost always itself a transcription factor. Now, if you activate a transcription factor, what will happen? It will bind to the corresponding DNA, allow RNA polymerase to begin, and you'll get messenger RNA. So you get messenger RNA. What I've written here, actually, what I wrote, is you change gene activity. So instead of changing the activity of pre-existing proteins, you make new proteins or more proteins. So by changing gene activity, we mean you make messenger RNA. And from messenger RNA, you make protein. And then the protein does its thing. Now, why is this an amplification device? One molecule of transcription factor can cause RNA polymerase to start many times, giving you lots of message. Then each message can be translated by many ribosomes, giving you much protein. So a small amount of signal gives you a decent amount of message, which gives you more protein, which gives you a lot of action. And you get your big effect or your big bang. So if you look at the stuff on the bottom, that just sort of summarizes everything we've said on the top, that the lipid-soluble signals usually use intracellular receptors, which generate transcription, translation, more protein. The transmembrane receptors either work through opening two sets of channels, or they work with different kinds of receptors, of which two major ones are listed here. So these can be either channels, and then there are two other possibilities listed here. So we're saying the kind of receptor which causes the generation of second messenger or protein binding, the kind of receptor that does this, there are two basic classes of receptor that do that. And these are written down here, the G protein coupled receptors and protein kinase linked. Now, these two types of receptors work, have different structures, and work in somewhat different manners. Usually, the G protein coupled receptors, about which you will hear much more, generally give you second messengers. Not always, but usually. Sometimes they bind to a protein and actually activate it. Well, they always bind to a G protein. That's why they're called G protein coupled receptors. But usually the G protein activates the production. I wrote second mRNA, which is wrong. It should be second messenger. And then the protein kinase receptors are receptors whose intracellular domain is a kinase. And usually it adds phosphates to tyrosine. So these are usually tyrosine kinase receptors. Many, many hormones use the G protein coupled receptors. Many growth factors use tyrosine kinase receptors. Now today we're not going to talk any more about the tyrosine kinase receptors. But when we get to the regulation of growth, we'll explain how they work. If we have time today, we'll talk more about how the G protein coupled receptors work. That is, once the receptor binds its ligand, how does that activate a G protein, whatever the heck that is? And how does a G protein lead to the generation of a second messenger? And what does the second messenger do? So we'll get to that at the end of today. Now, there are two questions in your notes, sort of at this point. They're sort of in the middle here, but they ask two questions. One is, of these three kinds of amplification, what's the relative speed, would you think, of those three? And the second question is, what kind of signal is released by exocytosis? Is it the lipid-soluble ones, the water, or the water-soluble ones? So what I'd like you to do is to think for a minute about these two questions, and then we'll go over that, sum it up, and then we're going to move on. So which type of amplification is faster, and why? So let's talk about the exocytosis one first. Actually, if you look at your handout, it sort of gives that one away. That we said that lipid-soluble signals actually can just diffuse out of the cell that makes them into their target cell. But how do water-soluble signals get out of their target cell? Well, as I said, the handout sort of gives it away, that what you have to have here is exocytosis. So water-soluble signal molecules generally accumulate in secretory vesicles and are released to generate the signal. Now that brings up an interesting question. Can you make water-soluble signals in advance and keep them around? Sure you can. You put them in a secretory vesicle and they wait. Can you make lipid-soluble signals in advance and keep them around? And the answer is no. Because a lipid-soluble molecule can get out of the cell. Putting a membrane around it doesn't help at all. There's no way to hold on to it. So lipid-soluble signals are generally created on demand by the appropriate enzyme. So now let's come back to our speed question. Which one is the slowest? A? Anybody? B? C? Well, the majority have C, and I think I have to agree, because, why is that? Notice here, you have to make new messenger RNA, and you have to make new protein. In the other two, you just change the distribution of pre-existing stuff, or you modify pre-existing stuff. So this one is the slowest, but it is sometimes thought to maybe make the biggest effect, but it's the slowest. Now, of A and B, which one is faster? How many people say A? People say B. Well, you happen to be right. A is what nerves use to send signals and is by far the fastest. B is slower, but not that much slower, but you still have to wait for an enzyme to modify a protein, and sometimes you have to wait for that to modify another protein, and then you have to wait for that to modify another protein. Well, in the case of A, you just open a channel, and whoosh, things go down their electrochemical gradient. Okay. Now, before we talk any more about signaling, I'd like to look at signaling from a different point of view. And this is on a handout B, where the different kinds of signaling are classified based this time on where does the signal come from and how does it get to its target. And we're going to go over this because these terms are used all the time. Now, the numbers on the left refer to the numbers in your notes if you want to go check it later. And so we'll do it in that order. Now, you notice there are two kinds of signaling discussed here. One is where the cell secretes a signal, and the other where the cells are in contact. So we want to do the cell secrete signal first. So in case one that you have on your handout, you have a cell that releases a signal, and we've been vague here whether it's lipid-soluble or water-soluble. The argument is the same. And that compound has to go through the blood in order to get to its target. If it's water-soluble, it'll go by itself. If it's lipid-soluble, it'll go bound to a protein. And then it leaves the blood and hits its target. So there are two features of this kind of signaling that are important. One is that the cell that makes the signal molecule is a specialized cell in a gland. And the target cell is fairly far away so that the signal has to go through the blood to reach its target. So this is long distance, and the source is a gland. And this is called endocrine, which is another word for hormones. And most of the famous hormones that you've heard of, like estrogen, insulin, prolactin, oxytocin, all of them work this way. So many, many hormones work, all the hormones virtually work in this way. Now, endocrine is usually compared either to paracrine or to exocrine. So maybe we should do exocrine first, which is actually 6 on the bottom. For comparison, endo means inside, exo means outside. Now, exocrine secretions or signal molecules are also made by a gland, but unlike the hormones, notice this gland has no duct. It has no exit ramp. glands that make exocrine secretions have a duct, and that duct either leads to the outside, as in a sweat gland, or it leads to a cavity inside that leads to the outside, like the inside of your gut. So these secretions essentially leave the body. Now, how could they be involved in signaling if they leave the body? The thought is that, at least in some cases, these secretions are not used to signal other cells of your body, but to signal other individuals. Now, there are some experiments that say that humans can detect secretions from other people, and these are called, the signals are called pheromones, as opposed to hormones. Human females are supposed to be able to tell the state of the male from which the sweat came under certain circumstances, and to tell male from female and things like that. But it's thought that pheromones don't play a big role in human sexuality, development, or behavior. But many other species, pheromones are very, very important. For example, insects use them for mating. The female releases a pheromone and the males fly in. And this actually has been adapted by humans for pest control, making traps baited with female pheromones. But for the moment, that's all I want to say about pheromones. I want to go back to signaling within this organism. And endocrine is compared to exocrine, but it's also compared to paracrine, which is 2 on the top. Now, I realize there's one thing I forgot to say before I leave endocrine, and this applies to paracrine as well. In your picture, there's a receptor here. That would be a receptor for what? What kind of signal? That would be a water-soluble one. But it also could be that we're talking about a lipid-soluble signal, too. So either kind of receptor could be used here. Now, in paracrine, you notice that what's missing is the blood part. There's a cell, and it makes a signal, and it releases it. And here you have to add also the other kind of signal. This is short-term signaling, short-range signaling, not long-range. And also, the cell that makes the signal is not a specialized cell. It's a plain, ordinary garden variety cell. And this is called paracrine signaling, where a cell signals its neighbors. And many growth factors are paracrines. And also, you probably heard of prostaglandins. These are derived from fatty acids, and they're used to signal other cells. And what aspirin does is to interfere with their production. Now, a variation on paracrine is number 3, which is autocrine. And the big difference there is that the cell signals itself. That the signals are released by the cell and bind to receptors on the outside of the same cell. Now, some cells do this normally, but perhaps some growth factors are like this, and that the cell at a certain point makes its own growth factors, which stimulates itself. But this autocrine business is thought to be extremely important sometimes in the development of cancer, where a cell that's supposed to get a signal from somebody else, it's supposed to be dependent on paracrines, becomes independent. It is able to make its own growth factor, which it didn't before, and stimulate itself, and now it can ignore signals from its neighbors and grow out of control. Okay. Now, there are two other categories in here, which are neurocrine and neuroendocrine. And they both have neuro in the title because the cell that makes the signal molecule is a nerve cell. And it is releasing the signal from the end of its axon. Now, there are two variations here which are equivalent, sort of, to endocrine and paracrine. And that is that this signal molecule can go a short distance and hit the next cell. And if it does that, it's just called a neurotransmitter. And that's called, so I guess that should be over here, and that's an example of a neurocrine secretion or neurocrine signaling. So it just signals the next cell. So it's short range, but the nerve cell made the signal molecule, not a special gland cell and not a regular ordinary body cell. And the final category is neuroendocrine. Now, as you might guess already from the names that you've heard, if it's neuroendocrine, it means that a nerve cell makes it. But the endocrine part means we're talking long distance. So if a nerve cell makes it, and the compound goes into the blood and goes long distance, then you call it neuroendocrine signaling. Now, this is a classic case of a classification system which is man-made and which the cells don't really know about, and that the same compound can be more than one of these things, and it's not always clear how to classify everything. But for convenience, this is a pretty good classification system. Now, just to give you an example of neurotransmitters, the most common neurotransmitters outside of the brain are acetylcholine and norepinephrine, also known as noradrenaline. It was discovered and named twice. On the other hand, the most common neuroendocrine is epinephrine. Now, both of these compounds can actually be transmitters, and most of them can be neuroendocrines. But usually, norepinephrine is the transmitter, and epinephrine is the neuroendocrine. Now, nor just means without a methyl. So these two molecules are extremely similar. They differ by one methyl group, and later on we'll go into their structure. But for now, we are not concerned with the structure of these various compounds. Some of these transmitters are small. Some of these signal molecules are small molecules. Some of them are proteins, and some of them are lipid soluble. Okay, so let me ask if there are any questions about things so far before we go to the next step. Yes. Where are the lipid-soluble receptors in the cell? Well, that's actually what I want to talk about next, but let me just say that some of them reside in the nucleus, and some of them reside in the cytoplasm. And when they bind their ligand, what they do exactly depends on where they are. They all go ultimately to the nucleus and bind to DNA. Yes?
So pretty much all neurotransmitters and neuroendocrines water-soluble as opposed to...
Are almost all neuroendocrines and neurotransmitters water-soluble? I think that's right. So what I wanted to do today is, first I want to talk about how these work. And then I want to talk about how these work, if whatever time we have remaining. So let's look at how the lipid-soluble signals tend to work. Now, in your notes, I've said, how do the intracellular receptors work? Doesn't really matter which end you focus on. All the lipid-soluble signals use the same type of intracellular receptor. And these intracellular receptors are all transcription factors. And these transcription factors all belong to the same superfamily of proteins, and they all have certain features in common. So if you write the protein with its amino and carboxyl ends in the usual orientation, all these transcription factor receptors have at least three different domains or areas. They have, the middle one is responsible for binding to DNA. And of course, different ones bind to different segments of the DNA. What would you think they would stick to? If you think of our picture of the start of transcription and the core promoter and proximal regulatory regions and distal regulatory regions, these transcription factor receptors bind to one of the regulatory regions, usually to the proximal. Now, if the signal molecule is a hormone, then the place where its receptor binds is usually called a hormone response element. If this sequence of DNA allows the cell to respond, say, to estrogen, then this would be called an estrogen response element. That's the name of the specific hormone. Now, what about those other two domains? This one is usually responsible for ligand binding. So if this were an estrogen receptor, estrogen would bind in this part. Now, what about the third part here, the first part? This is the part responsible for actually affecting transcription. Depending on the circumstances, it either inhibits transcription or activates transcription. Now, since most of these are activators, this is usually called the transcription activating domain, or sometimes the transacting domain. Trans because one end sticks to the DNA, but the other hand end stretches out and sticks to other cofactors, transcription factors, coactivators, etc. And in the case where we are inhibiting transcription, this would be called the transcription inhibiting domain. Perhaps the right term would be transcription affecting domain. Now, is this enough? If this is a transcription factor and a hormone receptor, Does it have to have any other properties? Clearly it has to bind ligand, has to bind DNA, and it has to stick to other part players in the transcription machine in order to affect transcription. But does it have to do anything else? There's actually one thing it has to have that you should be able to think about. What do you think?
A localization domain
where? Where will this thing end up and do its thing?
In the nucleus.
It's going to end up in the nucleus, right?
Yeah.
So that means it's made in the cytoplasm and imported into the nucleus at some point. So somewhere in here it has to have a nuclear localization signal. Now it has to have something else. As we will see, in order for these to work, they almost always dimerize. So some part in here is also responsible for dimerization. Okay. So let's see how one of these works. What happens when the ligand comes along? Well, first of all, the ligand, such as estrogen, binds to its receptor. That's the first thing you have to do, of course. But once the receptor has bound its ligand and changed conformation, what happens next? Now, usually the receptors dimerize, but before they can do that, usually they disassociate from inhibitors. Usually there are proteins in the cell that are inhibiting or blocking this transcription factor from doing anything until the ligand comes along. So when the ligand binds, that bumps the inhibitors. Remember we talked about a minus times a minus being a plus. If you inhibit the inhibitor or get rid of it, now you turn on the receptor. So if the receptor, then the receptor dimerizes, usually. That is, they come together in pairs, two stick together. And now the dimer with its ligand, if it's in the nucleus, it may move within the nucleus to the right piece of DNA. If it's in the cytoplasm, it moves to the nucleus. So it moves to the nucleus and it binds to the appropriate response element. That is, this is the transacting factor, and it binds to the right cis-acting regulatory element in the DNA. And now you get either transcription is either inhibited or activated. Activated or inhibited, the way I've written. Now, the details of this vary considerably, or depending on exactly what signal or hormone we're talking about and exactly what transcription factor, but the basic picture is pretty much the same. Now, I think it'll be clearer if we actually do an example or two here of what we're talking about. Most of the lipid-soluble signal molecules are steroids, although not all of them are. The big exception is thyroid hormone. Thyroid hormone is lipid-soluble, although it is not a steroid. But all the steroids and thyroid hormone work in this basic way. So let's look at estrogen, which is a steroid. Now, estrogen has many different effects on different cell types and at different times. And one of the things that it does is to affect the production of receptors for other hormones. Because remember what we said is, what do these lipid-soluble signals do? They bind to their transcription factor receptor, and then they trigger transcription, translation, and what do you make? In the case of estrogen, what you often do is you either produce receptors for other hormones or you inhibit the production of receptors for other hormones. And two examples are this. During pregnancy, estrogen affects both the uterus and the breast. and it affects prolactin receptors in the breast and oxytocin receptors in the uterus. Now, oxytocin and prolactin are two hormones that affect multiple factors. We will later on talk about the major hormones and their major roles of action. But one of the big things that oxytocin does is it stimulates the contractions of birth. So in order for birth to occur, there must be oxytocin receptors in the uterus. And when it's time for birth, you stop making estrogen and you start making oxytocin. So when it's time for birth, the oxytocin receptors had better be ready to roll. So one of the things that estrogen does is to stimulate the production of oxytocin receptors in the uterus. It binds to the hormone estrogen response element in front of the receptor gene, causes it to be transcribed, translated, and you make receptors. Now, what's prolactin do? Among other things, prolactin is responsible for stimulating milk production. Now, you don't want a lot of milk until the baby is born. As someone who has nursed, you do not want a lot of milk around if there's no one to drink. So you want prolactin receptors. You don't want them until after birth when you want them to respond to prolactin and to make milk. So in fact, what estrogen does is to inhibit transcription of the gene for prolactin receptors and block the production of prolactin receptors until birth. And then after birth, when we stop making estrogen, we'll relieve this inhibition, we'll start making prolactin receptors, the breast will then respond to prolactin and start making milk. And these details are summarized in your notes. But let me ask if there are any questions about this before we continue. Yes? Don't you inhibit production of both receptors? No. You stimulate oxytocin receptor production and you inhibit prolactin receptor production.
But you don't want oxytocin being produced like...
This is not oxytocin itself. These are the receptors for oxytocin. And then oxytocin itself will be produced after birth. Now, this illustrates a very common phenomenon, which is that the same signal has different effects in different tissues. Now, the reasons for that are various, but one of the major ones is that they depend entirely on what other proteins and factors are available in that particular cell type, because the hormone response elements are the same in both of these tissues. Think back and remember that the cis-acting sequences are always the same. The DNA is always the same. But the collection of proteins, cofactors, transcription factors, etc. is different. And that is what influences whether you get stimulation or whether you get inhibition and which genes are affected. And we will go more in the future into how you get different responses from the same signal. Now, are there any questions, more questions about this before we go on? Okay. Now, this is pretty much what I wanted to say about how the lipid-soluble signaling works. And I want to talk now about how water-soluble signals work. And we've already mentioned that there are two main types of receptors for water-soluble signals. And we're going to concentrate on this kind. Because many, many water-soluble signals and hormones use G-protein-coupled receptors. I think people have figured out that something like a half of the drugs which are currently in use affect them, affect G proteins and their receptors. So we want to talk about them. Now I see in the notes I have a few words about the difference, so I just want to say one thing. That these two types differ considerably in structure. And they also differ considerably in what their fundamental job usually is. Usually, G protein coupled receptors trigger the production of second messenger, which travels through the cell wherever it can find a target. And this is a kind of broadcast approach. You send out a signal and it gets received wherever it's appropriate. These protein kinase receptors tend to work in a somewhat different way. In that instead of sending out a signal, they tend to attract things to stick to them. When they change conformation, they become sticky, so to speak, and other proteins bind to them and other proteins bind to that, and you make a complicated stack up of activated proteins in one part of the cell. And that appears to be an important phenomenon, and the name for that that people usually use is just recruitment. So to activate other proteins, you can go find the other proteins, or the proteins can come to you. And what we want to consider now, though, is how this class works. And that's what's largely outlined on your final handout on 12C. So the picture in the middle shows you what the basic pathway is and what the basic players are. And then the other parts show you the details of the various players. So let's look first at the picture in the middle, which shows what the basic setup is. So here would be the plasma membrane. This would be the bilayer. And their transmembrane receptor would be embedded in the bilayer. This would be the outside of the cell and the inside. So I've drawn it like this. So this is the receptor. And this is the ligand binding domain of the receptor, which of course is outside of the cell. It's extracellular. And its ligand here, I realize I made its ligand a triangle. I probably should have made it a circle because this is a water-soluble ligand. Now, if this is a G protein-coupled receptor, it means that when this receptor binds its ligand and it changes conformation, what it does is to activate a so-called G protein. So that's the next thing here. And the G protein is also embedded in the membrane. But you notice all of these proteins have an intracellular side where they can access intracellular components. Now, G proteins are a big deal because they are activated easily, but they deactivate themselves. So they act as switches. And that's why they're involved in a very large number of processes, not just in signaling. We have, in fact, already met several processes which use G proteins, but we skipped over it. And we'll come back in a minute to how you activate a G protein. Once the G protein is activated, then you activate an enzyme in the membrane. And the most common enzyme that gets activated is adenyl cyclase, whose name is written there. Depending on your use of terminology, it's called either adenyl or adenylyl cyclase. And this is the enzyme which catalyzes the production of the second messenger. by converting ATP to a compound called cyclic AMP, whose structure is written below, and we'll come back to it in a minute. Remember we said the same molecules keep turning up over and over again? You've met ATP now in several different functions. This is another use of ATP to generate cyclic AMP. Now, there are other second messengers. There's one other famous second messenger that's generated in a similar way. You use a different enzyme, and you get a different compound. And there's a little table in your notes with the three most famous second messengers, and we will come back later and talk about them. But for now, today, we're going to stick to this one. Now, what was the first messenger here? The first messenger was the ligand, the hormone, or whatever the signaling molecule on the outside was. The cyclic AMP is the second messenger. Now, so far, we've already got some amplification. Exactly how much depends on how this works, the fine points. But even if it's one-to-one up to here, this is an enzyme. And even if only one molecule of ligand, of hormone, activates one molecule of adenyl cyclase, one molecule of adenyl cyclase can cause the production of many molecules of cyclic AMP. And now each of these molecules of cyclic AMP can go and find its target. And the major target, I have two arrows here, but it's really one process of diffusion through the cell. The cyclic AMP diffuses to its target, and its major target is protein kinase A, also known as cyclic AMP-dependent kinase. What's a kinase? It adds phosphates to something. What's a protein kinase? It adds phosphates to proteins. So this enzyme has many different substrates. So exactly what's going to happen is going to depend on which of its substrates are present in this particular cell. Whatever they happen to be, they will get phosphorylated. Some of them will work faster when phosphorylated. Some of them will work slower. Some will be activated. Some will be inhibited. So this is going to phosphorylate proteins, and then they're going to become either more active or less. Now, this is just this is pretty simple. It's often much worse. Often what happens is that protein kinase A phosphorylates some enzyme, which then phosphorylates somebody else, which then it can go on for several steps. Now, what's the advantage of that? Remember amplification. If the more steps you have here where one enzyme modifies another, the bigger the amplification is, and the more active enzyme you have at the end, and the more substrate gets made to product. In different pathways, there's a different extent of amplification. Now, in this one here already, we have two that from it, one molecule of ligand, you get multiple cyclic AMP, so you get many molecules of protein kinase active, and each of them can modify many molecules of the target protein. Whether there's any amplification up here is debatable. All right, now what this handout has is a blow-up of each of the pieces of this, important pieces of this pathway. So up on the top left is actually a drawing, a crude drawing, of what a G protein-coupled receptor looks like. Now, we have two things here. We have the G protein itself, and we have the receptor that activates the G protein. The G protein coupled receptor, also called G protein linked receptors, or GPCR is the most common acronym for G protein coupled receptor. All the G protein coupled receptors have certain similarities in structure, which is shown in your picture. They are all seven pass proteins. And this is in distinction to this class of proteins. These are almost all single pass. But the G protein coupled ones are all 7, and they all have the same sort of orientation. They look sort of like this. The amino ends on the outside, the carboxyl ends on the inside. And this is the part that binds the G protein. And this is the part that binds the signal or the ligand. So this is what we've been drawing as something like this. Or over there, the big block with the wedge in it. And this is the, when binding the ligand, this is the protein that changes conformation. So in our symbolism, it looks like that. So this is the receptor, but the interesting part of this receptor is that it activates a G protein. So now we finally bite the bullet. What is a G protein? So the picture up there on the right, on the top, shows you a typical G protein. Now, the critical thing about a G protein is that it has two forms, which I'm just going to draw this way to start. One of them has GDP on it, and one of them has GTP. Now, this is how it got the name G protein, because it binds guanine nucleotides, either GTP or GDP. And the critical thing is, remember we said it's a switch? It's active, inactive? This is the active form. When it's got GTP on it, that's when it sticks to adenyl cyclase and activates adenyl cyclase, or whatever its target happens to be. However, when it's got GDP on it, it's inactive. Now, remember we said it can hydrolyze the GTP itself, it can turn itself off? That's because it has the innate ability, it has the catalytic ability to hydrolyze the GTP to GDP. Now the question is, how does it get activated? To be activated, some protein has to stick to it. And in this case, it's the receptor. The receptor binds to it. And when the receptor binds to it, that triggers the conversion. Now, in kinases, you add a phosphate. G proteins don't do that. What G proteins do, the way they get from inactive to active, is not by phosphorylating the GDP. What happens is the GDP falls off and a new GTP comes on. And that's why I've used two different colors. Now, this is different from a kinase, of course. Kinases catalyze the addition of phosphate. I'm not adding phosphate here. Now, if you were to write this down as proper reactions, which in fact I've done in your notes, what you'd say is you have a protein that's inactive and that has GDP on it. And then you add GTP. Now, the GTP essentially bumps the old GDP. And so you end up with protein GTP and released GDP. And just to make it clear that these are the same, I'm going to draw this. Now, this reaction is triggered by some protein, in this case, the receptor that's bind its ligand. So that activates it. How do we inactivate it? Protein GTP. We'd have to put water in, but I've left it out. Gives you protein GDP.
phosphate.
Now, what is the net effect? The net effect is we've hydrolyzed one GTP. Because if you add all of this up, these cancel out. And these cancel out, really. And the net effect, well, no, these are the same. This one cancels out. So basically, the net effect of this is this GTP got hydrolyzed. And so these proteins are sometimes called GTP aces. Because one cycle of activation and inactivation hydrolyzes one GTP. So you can think about the energy, the high energy bond in GTP is being used here basically to run a switch. You turn the protein on, it does something, you turn it back off again. Now, what do you call this? People often call this also GTP-GDP exchange. To make it clear that you're not phosphorylating GDP. What you're doing is substituting one of these. You're substituting GTP for GDP in order to activate. Now, just one more piece of terminology in case you find it. Since this is called GTP-GDP exchange, what the activated receptor is doing is triggering or catalyzing or promoting exchange. So the general term for a protein that promotes activation is a GEF. And the reason people use the acronym is nobody wants to write the whole thing, which is in your notes, which is a guanine nucleotide exchange factor. It's a G exchange factor. Now, G proteins can deactivate themselves because they can hydrolyze the GTP to GDP. That is an innate function of the protein. However, there are other proteins that can either inhibit or activate, make this go faster, thereby making the switch shorter or longer. Now, there are two major types of, there's one major type of G proteins, and major G proteins, as shown on your handout, if you look at your picture again, are trimeric, just like it says. They have what's called an alpha, a beta, and a gamma subunit. There are some what are called small G proteins that are not trimeric, and they are not activated directly by receptors. They are activated by other things, and they're very important in growth, but we're not going to talk about them now. They've risen to prominence because they're messed up in cancer. But for now, we're going to stick to trimeric G proteins like this. Most of them are trimeric. And so GTP comes in, GDP goes out, and the protein, the G protein changes conformation. And so what tends to happen is the alpha comes off from the beta and the gamma. So now we have pretty much the picture that's on your handout that when you activate, they come apart, and the alpha, because it has the GTP, changes conformation, and now it binds to something and activates it, or sometimes it's the other half. When the G protein comes apart, either half can go do the business, can be the actual effector and get something done. Either, and in some cases both, can bind to targets and activate or inhibit. But now, after a short amount of time, what's going to happen? The alpha is going to hydrolyze the GTP back to GDP. It's going to change back to shape. It's going to stick to the beta gamma, and we're going to go back to where we were. So the protein is only in the activate or action shape for a short time. Thank you. Now, there are many different G proteins, and they're involved in a lot of different processes. Some of them activate, some of them inhibit. There actually may be, when I say there are many of them, there are probably about six that are commonly invoked and well known. And the symbolism used for them is different depending on which book you read. And some of it is written in your notes, but you should be aware that not everybody does it the same way. Now, if we go back to our big picture here. We said that the ligand binding to the receptor, to the G protein coupled receptor, changes its conformation. That causes it to act as a G exchange factor and activate the G protein. The G protein loses its GDP and picks up a GTP. So now while it's active, it binds to the next player, to the enzyme in the membrane, and activates it. And now the adenyl cyclase makes cyclic AMP. Now, how long will this go on? It won't go on very long because the G protein will hydrolyze its own GTP back to GDP. And as a result, it'll stop stimulating adenyl cyclase. So from one little bit of ligand, you get one jolt of activated G protein, one jolt of activated adenyl cyclase, and one bunch of cyclic AMP. Exactly how many molecules you get is debatable, but it's a lot more than one. So now, how did we get cyclic AMP, and what happens to it? And that's the final part on the bottom of your handout, which shows how you make cyclic AMP. Cyclic AMP is called that because this is the 3' position, this is the 5' position. Now it's called cyclic 5', 3' because there's a phosphate in between these two positions. Normally either it would have a phosphate on the 3' or it would have a phosphate on the 5', but this one has a phosphate in between. Now, remember that we turned off the G protein after a little bit. It turns out we turn off the cyclic AMP too, because if we didn't, the cyclic AMP would last forever, and the pKa would be activated forever, and the targets would be affected forever. So we want to turn this signal off as well. And any time you send messages, you want to be able to turn them off. So just as there is an enzyme that makes cyclic AMP from ATP, there is an enzyme that converts cyclic AMP to plain old AMP, and that's shown on your handout. That's the enzyme called PDE, which stands for phosphodiesterase. Because this thing is a phosphodiester. So what it does is to break this connection and turn cyclic AMP back into plain old 5' AMP. And now that can be rephosphorylated and we can back up to ATP and we can do it again. But this has no signaling activity. So that how long the cyclic AMP lasts is going to depend on how active the phosphodiester is. If the phosphodiesterase is very active, the cyclic AMP won't stay around very long, and the effects will be limited. If the phosphodiesterase is blocked, then the cyclic AMP effect lasts longer. Now, there are many hormones that work in this way. Epinephrine control of glycogen breakdown was the first to be discovered. Thyroid stimulating hormone works this way. Now, we talked about thyroid hormone. That's what your thyroid makes. But in order for the thyroid to do it, it has to get the signal from somewhere else. And that signal is called thyroid stimulating hormone, or TSH. And if you want for reference later, you can look in your notes, which shows how that works. It's written out step by step. that what would happen is the thyroid stimulating hormone would be the ligand. It binds to its receptor, triggers a G protein, triggers adenyl cyclase, causes cyclic AMP to be made, activates protein kinase A. And then protein kinase A phosphorylates a whole bunch of enzymes needed to make thyroid hormone. Thyroid hormone is a very complicated compound, and many steps in its production have to be triggered. And many of the enzymes involved in its production become phosphorylated and work better, and you make thyroid hormone. And thyroid hormone is lipid-soluble. So when it reaches its target, it binds to a transcription factor inside the cell and works through transcription translation. Now, the only other piece of this that we should mention is that the first example of a second messenger was cyclic AMP. But there are other second messengers. And therefore, there are other enzymes which can be activated by G proteins to make different second messengers which trigger different effects. And we're not going to talk about them now at all. But after we do nerve communication, we're going to come back and do a couple of examples of the other cases so that you have the picture. So we're going to stop here. And next time, Dr. Feierstein will pick up with nerve communication.